It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. Coming up, we'll talk about the best songs to celebrate spring and look ahead to some of the biggest concerts coming to Wisconsin in the next few months.
First, when you think about the platforms that presidential candidates run on, they usually fall under the same categories, things like immigration, defense, the economy, and more.
But our next guest says one important topic has fallen under the radar in the 2016 campaign, space exploration and the funding of NASA.
Tyler Rogaway is a defense journalist. He talks about the issue in a recent piece titled, "The Fact That None of the 2016 Presidential Candidates Have a Space Policy is Tragic." Tyler, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, hey, great to be here.
Well, in that piece we just mentioned that you wrote, you say it's a shame that the candidates running for president this year don't have a space policy. So why? Why does that worry you?
You know, in the past, I've always seen, the past elections, space has been an issue. It has been at least something that was, it's an issue that meant something to the candidates, whether that's pushed by, space policy at the moment or by, the public's interest in space. It didn't matter, but at least they had some sort of position on it. And now it's amazing that there's not even a mention of it on their website. I mean, yet alone being asked in the debate or, even on television or whatever about space. And without that, I think our country is losing something much more than just, interest in a program or, the potential, our youth being interested in, science and math. It's much more, and it goes into not just those issues, but also into our future ability to be a leader in the world, especially economically.
So what do we lose beyond, as you mentioned, the sort of inspiration people talk about for science and technology for young people? What are we losing if we're not having this focused attention at the top of the political system on space?
Well, I think the main thing, and I talked about this in that piece, is the potential that we lose to basically set our country up to make to be very powerful economically in the coming decades. Apollo, whether people are interested in it or not, the moonshot gave us a ton of the technologies that made us very wealthy for the coming decades that followed. And it allowed us to beat the Soviet Union economically and technologically in the late 1980s and mid-1980s. So now without that, we have this staggering system. And people say, hey, commercial space, we've got now companies that are doing this. Well, yeah, we've actually stood pretty still watching these companies relearn what we learned in the late 1950s and 1960s. So I think there's a huge opportunity there to basically allow us to learn about the things that are most important today, green sciences, battery powers, photovoltaics, all these things, we can make a big jump by, actually invigorating space, not sort of just leaving it behind as a background issue.
Well, you give the example of one idea people talk about, the idea of, hey, let's park some people on Mars for a while, maybe 6 months, and then bring them back. So if we tackled a technological challenge like that, engineering challenge, social challenge too, and with a deadline, what kind of spinoffs do you see from that could benefit us, not just on Mars, but here on Earth?
Right, and like I just kind of mentioned, the green technology is a big deal today, right? We hear about it all the time. It's hot in the news. It's actually becoming a good money maker for our country. And I think if you really want to learn how to, do more with less here on the planet, whether you're on the right or the left, really, this is just really about money, too, just being able to sell these technologies. Put three people, four people in a tin can, send them to Mars and back and alive, and you're going to get huge leaps in solar power and fuel cells, battery power, and then just the actual material sciences it takes to make this happen. And this intellectual property can set us up economically for years to come. It's the return on investment that is the thing that NASA and I think people that are interested in space and want to see this happen are missing. It's not just about the science, we should do it and it's good for our soul. It's that let's make money doing this. Let's make us rich for the future doing this. And that's how you sell this. And that's what's missing.
We're talking about space policy and lack of same. Our guest is defense journalist Tyler Rogoway. Well, let's look at the public here. The politicians maybe are just reflecting a lack of interest from the public. People are thinking we're worried about our jobs. We're worried about health care in the future. Space sounds nice, but we've got better, more direct investments to make here at home.
You know, and that's a great argument. And you know, we do see that disconnect. I do talk about that in that piece a bit. But the truth is, when you poll the public, they really support space exploration. It's just not a topic. Nobody's carrying that torch forward, right? So it's not out there. But if you ask them, and actually, let's just talk about how they vote with their wallets, right? Not just saying, oh, yeah, Mars would be great. Okay, fine. Look at what's hot in the theaters, right? I mean, we had The Martian was like a number one movie of the year, heavy science movie, okay? Not fighting island, aliens in space with, you know, laser rifles. This was about space exploration, okay? Made well over $100 million, hundreds of millions of dollars in the theaters. The same we had with Gravity, you know? That was sort of a similar deal. And even Interstellar. So people are interested in this. They're interested in the fiction because the reality isn't exciting. We need to make the reality exciting, and it's not – there's putting people in a space station, which is fine, you know, and bringing them back. That's interesting. That's a news tag. That's not a movement, okay? We need to create – we have to have the right leadership create a movement for space and sell it, not just say, science is great, look what we did today, and it's gone the next day.
Well, you're talking about leadership and saying we need to do something. I mean, does this need to be a president who does this? Do we need somebody with the focus on the space program like a JFK?
You know, it really would help, right? That would be the best to have the leadership there to help do it. At least they could put somebody in place to do it. But I think that there could be, I mean, it doesn't just have to happen there. You need the right person to package this and sell it properly. The problem is like a NASA administrator would be great for this, but they're really the lapdogs of the president. You know, they're just there to enforce the policy and then run, you know, what they have from there. So yeah, maybe the right senator, maybe the right person that has that incredible charisma to do it, but it's not going to be done with science talk. I don't know how to put this, you know, in a way that isn't disparaging because I love all that. It needs to impact and make a case publicly. You know, we have a big rocket that's being built that we're spending billions of dollars on. That the reality of it is, it has no mission. It's over decades of, it's going to be multiple presidents that have to fund this thing to go nowhere. So we need short time scales, real goals, and somebody who can sell it. President would be nice.
Do we need to change how we run this whole thing? As you say, the NASA administrator is beholden to the president, but a space plan of 5 or 10 years could go beyond a presidential term in office, beyond the term of senators who might back the program. Do we need a structural change, in your view, to make these kind of missions a reality?
I think so, and I think it might include NASA giving up its exploration in a certain way, giving up its mission for exploration, manned exploration, and maybe putting that into a subgroup of people that can run that and not having it part of big NASA, that can maybe outsource it, certain parts of it, and get it going, and maybe a hybrid with the private sector. There could be other ways of doing this. The problem is we're not even discussing that. It's either public or private in that world. And you know, NASA, we're kind of holding on to the old NASA. And anybody, a lot of people, if you talk about anything negative about NASA, that they haven't accomplished the goals, they stopped, you know, going and exploring manned space flight beyond, low Earth orbit after Apollo, you know, people get offended. But it's not working. Right now is not working what we're doing, and we need to do something else.
We'll leave it there for now. Tyler, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, great being with you.
Tyler Rogoway is a journalist who covers defense for Foxtrot Alpha. That's part of the Gawker Media Group.
It looks like spring is on the way here in Wisconsin, but the state's weather isn't the only thing that's heating up.
With nicer weather comes spring and summer concerts to look forward to, which started up last weekend when the boss Bruce Springsteen visited Milwaukee.
And we still have concerts from artists like Chicago, Adam Lambert, and Raina to look forward to. So with the changing weather and shows, we're talking about great songs to celebrate spring.
Joining us now is Piet Levy, music writer from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Piet, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. Happy spring. Yeah.
Well, to you, too. Yeah. Well, you're excited. Well, that's great. But what are you excited about? Give us a couple more artists that are coming to Wisconsin, maybe the Milwaukee area, in the coming months.
Yeah, sure. Well, coming up pretty soon, we've got The Who. They're playing March 21st at the BMO Harris Bradley Center. It's actually a really big month at the Bradley Center. There was The Boss, and that show was crazy. He did like 3.5 hours. It was an awesome, awesome show. And The Who's playing, and then at the end of the month, there's Chicago Earth, Wind & Fire are sharing a bill.
Wow.
I'm pretty pumped about The Who. You know, they've got so many, you know, classic rock songs, and they're actually supposed to play in October, but they had to postpone their whole tour because Roger Daltrey had viral meningitis. So now he's in good shape. He'll be able to do that kind of, you know, yeah, scream for it won't get fooled again. And I'm looking forward to it. It'll be fun.
And to remind people about The Who, here's a little bit of The Seeker.
Piet, so you put together sort of a thematic springtime inspirational music based on bands coming to Wisconsin, The Who coming, as you said. So why The Seeker? I mean, I could see that that's a good window rolled down while you're driving kind of song.
Oh, definitely. Definitely so, you know. And that was, just for me personally, that was the first Who song like I really like fell in love with. I just love that song. I love the vocals, love the guitar. But yeah, definitely. If you crank that song up and you're driving, you just feel like really cool. So yeah, I can't wait to hear it live.
Yeah, I can tell it's spring because yesterday I was walking down the block here in Madison and someone was blasting music. And usually by the end of summer, I'm super annoyed. I just think, can't you turn it down a little? But because we're just hearing this music outside, it felt really good to hear it. So are the songs you gave us all songs and bands that are good to crank and roll down your window?
Yeah, I would think so. There's one that stands out that actually has a Wisconsin connection. So you could probably crank it, and there probably wouldn't be people annoyed because it's not like you're playing like Iggy Azalea, you know, a billionth time. You can play this, and maybe you'll actually be like, some people be like, oh, what is that? That's pretty cool. So I'd recommend Raina, which is a Milwaukee band, sisters that were in a really popular Milwaukee band called Vic and Gab. They've rebooted with the synth pop group, and they've got this really ambitious, slick, fun sound. And Spill Your Colors is one of only two tracks they've done so far, but really is really, you know, really good looking stuff, really good sounding stuff. They were on our Journal Sentinel Wisconsin Bands to Watch list for the year, and you can find out more about them at jsonline.com/bands to watch. And they're doing their very first concert ever at the Cactus Club in Milwaukee, March 26th. I think this is a band that's really going to go places, so if you make it to that show, you could say, I saw Raina at their very first show.
Well, at Central Time, always ahead of the curve. In this case, thanks to your recommendation, Piet, here's a listen to Spill Your Colors by Raina.
The Milwaukee group Raina right there. And Piet, did you say that they're playing in Milwaukee at the Cactus Club? Did you say they're going on a bigger tour too?
They probably will be soon, but they're still kind of getting their legs a little bit in terms of the live show. But they worked with their management company, is the same company that used to manage Lorde, really kind of helped Lorde get to become a superstar. So this will be the first taste of the Raina show. But Vic and Gab, the sisters from Vic and Gab are in Raina. They're really great live performers. They did tons and tons of shows with Vic and Gab. So I have strong confidence that this show will be really good.
Big taste of the 80s there, it sounds like.
Yeah, definitely some 80s kind of, you know, electronic pop sound there.
And it seems like that's in right now, doesn't it, Piet, or is it just me? It seems like we're having big 80s nostalgia.
Yeah, it's definitely in. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if we hear more kind of 90s nostalgia. My wife and I were just listening to Meghan Trainor's song today, and it kind of reminds me of like Christina Aguilera, like circa like 2000, 2001. So we might even get some early 2000s nostalgia coming soon, too.
Talking to Piet Levy from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's giving us some inspiring, upbeat springtime music based on bands that are playing in Wisconsin in the coming months. Let's bring on a caller now. We've got Dave on the line in Augusta. Dave, hi.
Hey, My song request is our request. My song title is by Elton John, and I remember back in 75, this song was released on the first day of spring, and we got like 18 inches of snow. And I was so ready for spring, and every time I hear this song, I think of that day.
What's the song?
Philadelphia Freedom.
Philadelphia Freedom by Elton John. I don't know if I know that one, but I could see Elton John being really inspiring on a spring day, Piet.
Yeah, oh yeah, for sure. Elton John would be some good spring music. We haven't seen Elton John in Wisconsin in a while. I think he's doing a Vegas residency, unfortunately, but it'd be nice to kind of come back here. But that's hilarious. That's so Wisconsin, right? I mean, the weather's been pretty nice in Milwaukee, but I still, like, back in my mind, I'm thinking, oh, yeah, maybe that, like, you know, massive blizzard could still come, like, next week. You just never know.
You got to keep your guard up because you don't want to be caught, you know, unawares with the snow.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Dave. Appreciate that. And Piet, another high-energy group is going to be performing at El Verno College in April. What can you tell us about the Jones Family Singers?
Yeah, Jones Family Singers is a gospel group. They're relatives. I think the father in the group, some sisters or daughters. They're playing April 30th at El Verno College. El Verno College has had this really interesting performing arts series called El Verno Presents. They've brought a lot of just a really eclectic, lineup of artists for 56 years. And it's just, you know, there's been a lot of world music. They've done some really interesting curated programs with local musicians. They've just done a lot of very interesting stuff that you can't really hear anywhere. But El Verno College has kind of reprioritized its priorities with its funding. So El Verno Presents is wrapping up. This show with Jones Family Singers is the last El Verno Presents show after 56 years. But at the same time, while that's, kind of a sad note, the Jones Family Singers is a really, really uplifting, you know, kind of funky gospel group. And I can only imagine that show is going to be super spirited. And, you know, no matter what your religious beliefs are, if you hear the Jones Family Singers, I think it'll just suddenly just your heart will just start skipping beats.
Well, here's the Jones Family Singers, the song Down on Me. Upbeat is the right word there, Piet.
Yeah, it's just, I think there'll be, you know, I think there'll be a lot of kind of sad people that come in because it's the last show, but at the same time, I can't imagine people leaving sad. I think that's just going to be a really uplifting show.
Nice. It's fun to get a handle on these new discoveries. And here's one that's probably not a new discovery. My kids will love this suggestion. Carly Rae Jepsen is on your list. This is the call me maybe person. What's your story there?
Yeah, so she's unlike any other pop artist in a way. I mean, Call Me Maybe kind of was a massive hit in 2012, and she was kind of the song of summer queen that year. And I think a lot of people kind of expected she'd be a one-hit wonder. She had an album that came out that, you know, it was okay, but she's really kind of rebooted in a lot of ways. She had an album called Emotion that came out last year that was really critically acclaimed and just really solid pop music. And there was actually a lot of outcry because she got snubbed entirely at the Grammys. At the same time, you know, it's just she's kind of all over the place. She did that. She starred on the Fox Grease special that was in January. She did Cinderella on Broadway. She did the Fuller House theme song. And she's going to be playing at the Pitchfork Music Festival, which usually that's like a bunch of like really hip, trendy artists. And then there's, you know, a pop artist, Carly Rae Jepsen, who does the Fuller House theme song. But, you know, she's the only one that can really kind of pull that off. That album Emotion is really good.
Let's give a listen. This is Carly Rae Jepsen. I Really Like You. Weird that Pitchfork would feature. I usually think of Pitchfork as too cool for even me to even look at. Well, I want to get to one more of the songs you suggested. You actually picked probably the perfect springtime song. I think of this song as maybe the happiest song ever. I'll give a listen. Creedence Clearwater Revival, Looking Out My Back Door.
Yeah. Just got home from Illinois. Locked the front door.
Pretty soon I'm singing. can't help but sing along, at least with the bass line, as I did there.
Yeah, Some of us helped it.
And John Fogerty, lead singer there, coming to Wisconsin.
Yeah, he's coming May 22nd, I believe, at the Riverside Theater. And, you know, he hasn't done a full show here, I think, like 7 years, something like that, you know, close to 10 years. He did a very, very brief cameo appearance with Kid Rock at the Harley-Davidson 105th a couple years back. But he was, like, on stage for literally 10 minutes. So it was the best part of that show and also extremely disappointing because he was on, he did a couple of hits, and he was off really quickly. You know, if he went and got a beer, he would have missed the whole thing. So it's going to be cool that he'll come back, play a lot of songs. I'm hearing he's still doing great live. So I'm really excited to kind of see the full set with Fogerty.
So you gave us a big list here. Anybody not on your list, some runner-ups that you want to mention before we let you go, Piet?
Geez, you know, I think if you go to jsonline.com/music, I have a list of 15 spring concert recommendations. And, you know, there's Earth, Wind & Fire is definitely on there with Chicago. There's going to be a really interesting punk bill supporting WMSC FM in Milwaukee with some really cool punk artists from Milwaukee that are reuniting. There's an electronic act called Made of Oak that's kind of different. Not, you know, it's a little dancey, but definitely a little odd and really interesting, and that also has Milwaukee ties. So, you know, I just encourage folks to kind of check that out and just check out some live music, discover some new stuff, and, you know, it's just really fun to share some stuff with you guys today.
Great. Well, Piet, it's a lot of fun. Thanks so much for bringing the music along.
No, thanks a lot for having me. You guys take care.
That was music writer Piet Levy talking about some great songs to celebrate spring from artists that are scheduled to visit Milwaukee in the coming months.
Coming up, we'll hear about new tenure changes approved today for the UW system. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
The University of Wisconsin System's Board of Regents today approved a new tenure policy for the system. The controversial changes add provisions for layoffs and system-wide post-tenure reviews.
Joining us to explain the details of what was approved is WPR's Assistant News Director, Kyla Calvert-Mason. Kyla, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, Kyla, this debate about tenure goes back about a year when the state legislature stripped tenure protections from state law. Now, since then, what's happened to get us to where we are today?
So when they stripped the tenure provisions out of state law, they basically handed the power for making those policies to the Board of Regents, which is a pretty common arrangement in other states. And so they said that they were giving the Board of Regents the power to set standards for layoffs under the circumstances of budget or program decisions that would lead to programs changing, being curtailed, or discontinued. And so when the tenure provisions were stripped out of state law, the Board of Regents just took the language from state law and adopted it right away to provide some continuity, they said, and also created a task force to create a new set of policies that they planned to adopt by April of this year. And so this is sort of the end of that process.
And so the Regents did meet today. What did they decide going forward?
So they made some changes to how tenure is granted, but the really big, the controversial changes added the possibility for layoffs when programs are discontinued. So they didn't really take all of the power that the state legislators handed over to them. You can't just slightly change a program and have faculty layoffs. You have to totally discontinue it. But under the state law previously, tenured faculty could only be laid off in the case of just cause or when there was a campus or system-wide financial emergency. So this adds sort of another circumstance under which faculty can be laid off. The other large change that faced a lot of controversy was to creating a system-wide uniform policy for post-tenure job reviews. So periodically, faculty will, you know, have job reviews, and there will be a process for if faculty are deemed to be underperforming to remediate them or eventually terminate them if they don't sort of step it up.
And Board President Regina Miller explained the thinking behind these changes. Can you tell us what we're going to hear here?
She was basically sort of defending the proposal that was before the board today in the face of sort of challenges that the changes would erode academic freedom across the system.
Here it is.
At the core of what we have been doing literally for ever since we were, it was signaled that this might happen. At the core was our desire to protect academic freedom, with our desire to be comparable to our peers, and our desire to have this be a financially stable institution going forward.
And that was Board President Regina Milner. And some faculty members and others were there working till the 11th hour, the 12th hour, trying to get some last-minute amendments included in these changes. Can you tell us briefly what they were looking for and whether they had any success?
Well, when it comes to this provision for ending academic programs that would lead to faculty layoffs, the tenure policy says that that academic programs can be ended for economic reasons. And so the faculty were pushing back on that, saying that it should really, these decisions should only be made for academic reasons, and that when those decisions are made, they should be subject to the approval of a board of faculty, instead of sort of being the final decision now rests in the hands of the administrators. They also wanted to see some additional language about severance for laid off faculty. They also wanted to see some more specific language about faculty review of these remediation and termination decisions from those post-tenure reviews, and the board did not accept any of those amendments, didn't approve any of them.
And one more bit of audio here from this morning. This is Regent Jose Vasquez weighing in on how the debate has been framed. What did he say?
Well, like I was saying, the faculty were saying, oh, these changes are going to erode academic freedom. And sort of on the other side, regents and others were saying, well, we really have to look at the financial situation that the university is in and be realistic about that. And he was saying that those two things aren't really in opposition.
The crisis was not created internally. The crisis was the lack of state support. The crisis was the lack of the ability to allow us to raise tuition. It is about money. But believe you me, doing all of this stuff isn't going to give us the money that we need to operate this system as the quality that we need. The money, this is a public institution, and the state needs to come to understand what does public institution mean.
That was Jose Vasquez, regent, this morning at the meeting. And we've heard a couple of sides there. This has been very contentious in Wisconsin and beyond. What happens next? Is this the end of this, or do we expect to see more action maybe from faculty and staff who are unhappy with these changes?
Well, I imagine that there will be some action at the campuses, because what happens now is the campuses have to develop their own policies under sort of the umbrella that the policies adopted today create for the system. So they have to develop their own specific policies and bring them back to the board to be approved, and I imagine that there will be a lot of faculty input on all of those campus-level policies.
Kyla, thank you so much. That was Kyla Calvert-Mason there, WPR's assistant news director.
UW System President Ray Cross has said that these changes put tenure in line with policies of similar systems at other universities.
Joining us now to talk about how tenure works across most universities is Susan Johnston. She's the executive vice president of the Association of Governing Boards of Universities and Colleges. Susan, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to start with UW System President Ray Cross's statements recently that these changes that we've been talking about, these tenure changes, will put the university in line with its peer institutions. Now, your organization is centered on governance in higher education. Do you agree with that?
I'm sure that there are institutions with exactly this sort of structure, but the more common way that tenure plays out looks a little different, and I think that the conversation around putting economic reasons behind the decisions for terminating programs or changing programs or laying off faculty would be different in a lot of places.
Is there a movement across higher education to change tenure, maybe similar to what we saw this morning in Wisconsin, or is Wisconsin maybe at the vanguard of something here or standing on its own?
Well, there's no denying the fact that tenure is, across the country, less strong than it has been in the past. There are fewer faculty who are tenured or on tenure track, but that is – often at institutions that are not research institutions. And so when you look at putting, for instance, the University of Wisconsin against its fellow flagship institutions, I think that's where the contrast might be in terms of these changes.
Right. You said it would look a little different if you were comparing across the board at I guess, peer institutions. What are the differences? How would you describe what that might be?
Well, I think it's the language that I heard earlier in your segment that that tenured professors may be terminated for cause or in times of financial exigency, so severe financial emergency at an institution. So tenure isn't a guarantee. A lot of people think it's a guarantee of a job. It isn't. But I think that the shift from financial exigency to economic reasons is a significant shift in the position of tenure within the state university system.
How would you describe the difference between finances and economics here?
Perhaps it's not resting on the words finances and economics, but it is resting on how decisions are made about program discontinuation and laying off of faculty. And that process, as you might find it more traditionally and perhaps among more research institutions, has a process that involves a presentation of data that shows the emergency nature of the decision making. The concern might be if it is for something less than that, that decisions about tenure may be swayed by market trends that can come and go, that may have potentially political forces behind them. Another cut to funding, which would not be for educational reasons, but perhaps for other reasons within a state, that could lead to the cut of tenured faculty for reasons that aren't educationally valid.
Is there any evidence out there showing that overhauling tenure, maybe something similar to this, is a solution for budget issues?
Well, I think that a good many institutions look at the option of not having tenure as providing flexibility. So flexibility of hiring, flexibility in funding, flexibility in programming. But flexibility in itself is not necessarily the greater good. You don't want to give up longer-term vision of the public good, longer-term vision of high quality for short-term solution that might require some flexibility. And I think that's where the issue is. How do you make sure that tenure is used for the purposes I think it exists for, to ensure high-quality, excellent faculty, cutting-edge research, but when some of the criteria change that tenure may be foregone if there is an economic reason that may require some flexibility, then you're moving into an area where I think quality can be at risk.
We're talking today about the decision on tenure this morning at a meeting of the UW System Board of Regents. Susan Johnston is our guest. She's the Executive Vice President of the Association of Governing Boards of Universities and Colleges.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with this decision to change tenure policy? Do you have problems with the changes? What do you think of the role of tenure in colleges and universities? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our discussion now on tenure in wake of the news that the University of Wisconsin System Board of Regents today approved a new tenure policy for the system. The controversial changes add provisions for layoffs, system-wide post-tenure reviews, which could lead to terminations.
And you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with the decision to change tenure policy? Do you take issue with those changes? Let us know what you think by calling 800-642-1234, or you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Susan Johnston is our guest. She is Executive Vice President of the Association of Governing Boards of Universities and Colleges. And we take a phone call now. We've got Jim on the line in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
Hi, thank you for having me on. I think that this is simply a further, this is ideologically consistent with Scott Walker's administration's anti-labor, anti-education policies that have resulted in $150 million in education cuts while, you know, pursuing trickle-down economics. This is, you know, and the, you know, the right-to-work state, despite Wisconsin's long-standing tradition of rights to union organization. It is simply ideological, not educationally based.
Jim, thanks for the call. Appreciate that. And Susan, thoughts about this? Is this a political thing?
Well, you know, it could well be. The main thing that I think the caller was getting at was the beginning of the with the cuts of the budget to the budget. That then also had this these other effects related to the tenure policies being removed from the state and put into the board's hands and then onto the institutions. You know, in some ways, that's a good thing to move the discussion of tenure into closer to the campus and out of state statute. But much depends upon how that gets played out.
Do you think that supporters of strong tenure protections have done a good job at making the case to maybe the non-academic public about what tenure is and why they think it matters?
I think you could always make that case more strongly. It is I think it's an important case to make because, to me, it goes right to the heart of education quality. And at any state, I think that you want your public university system and your institutions to be strong and stable. You want them to produce great research dollars that come into the university, have a positive effect on the state and local economies. It provides significant support to the university. I think that tenure is a sign of good quality. It's a sign of within the industry of higher education, it helps promote the brand and the reputation, and it helps recruiting. And it can always be made clearer to people what the value is.
And you've given us a nice list there of what the effects of tenure are, but how would you describe, someone in your position with your organization, how would you describe what tenure is?
I would say it's one of the bedrock principles of higher education. It's a protection that colleges and universities offer faculty, but only after a period of probation that typically is around 7 years. And a lot of scrutiny of performance, of teaching and research. So the value that I think tenure provides an institution is that the faculty members are allowed to teach and do research in areas that may be controversial, but they do it without fear of political interference. To me, that is where the value to the state comes, the value to the country comes, and the value to the students, where conversation and research and writing and critical thinking are all able to go where their thinking takes them without worry that this could jeopardize a job.
And Susan, just very briefly as we wrap up, what was your reaction to these changes here in Wisconsin, both at a professional level and maybe, if you can, on a personal level?
Well, when the story first started in the fall, I guess it was, I was very concerned about what was going on with higher education in Wisconsin. It seems to me that Wisconsin has a long, noble reputation in higher education as one of the leading states and institutions in the country for both teaching and research, graduate preparation, undergraduate teaching, and I was very worried about what it might mean. I think that moving this decision into the regent's hands was a good idea, and I think the regents acted quickly to make sure that policies were in place and have been very thoughtful about how they have examined the next steps for their policy. So I applaud them for that. I continue to be concerned about the of how it will actually be played out when economic reasons trump academic reasons for the structure of an institution's educational programs.
Susan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Susan Johnston, Executive Vice President of the Association of Governing Boards of Universities and Colleges. She joined us there to talk about today's Board of Regents vote to change tenure policy at the UW system.
If you noticed traffic jams and long lines near downtown Madison yesterday, it wasn't a basketball tournament or a visit from the president. It was the Dalai Lama, the spiritual leader of Tibet, on his 10th visit to Madison.
Wisconsin Public Radio's own Steve Paulson was there when the Dalai Lama spoke yesterday. Steve is the executive producer of To the Best of Our Knowledge, and he's here to tell us about it. Steve, thanks for stopping by.
Sure, happy to.
So, Steve, this is the Dalai Lama's 10th visit to Madison. Why does he keep coming back here so often?
Well, he has strong personal connections with people around here. He's known leaders at the Buddhist monastery outside of Madison, Deer Park, for years. And he also knows the neuroscientist Richard Davidson at the University of Wisconsin, who has done some groundbreaking research on the study of mindfulness and how this can actually rewire the brain. And the Dalai Lama is very interested in science, and especially the science of the mind. And so he has, I think, a lot of incentives to keep coming back.
And you've heard him speak before, but this time around, what were his main messages?
Well, I would say, the core of his message was, if you want to change the world, you got to start with yourself. You got to start with the individual. And at one point he said, if one person can sort of develop the skills of well-being and mindfulness, then 10 people will get this, and then 100, and then 1,000, and then 10,000. And there was one comment that really struck me. He was saying, sort of this utopian idea of, world peace, and he was saying, look, this is not going to happen in my lifetime. And he's, 80 years old now. But he said, I think it could happen this century. And he said, I think that's realistic. I thought, wow, okay.
You don't hear people saying that terribly often.
No, you don't.
But I guess if anyone's going to say it, it should probably be someone like the Dalai Lama.
Yeah.
And describe the scene there for us. What was that like? Were there a lot of people? I mean, certainly outside the venue, there were a lot of people.
Oh, well, it's packed. It's quite an event whenever the Dalai Lama comes. And as you say, he's been here a lot, but there's a lot. There's a buzz. There's, one of the most revered people in the world. And, and he has a very inviting presence. He's obviously a very deeply wise man. He laughs a lot, and he's someone who you want to be in his presence.
And the Dalai Lama, as you said, he has this long-standing friendship with Richard Davidson on campus, who runs the Center for the Investigation of Healthy Minds at UW-Madison. Did that kind of science inform the talk at all?
Yes, that really was what the talk was about. So there were several experts who study mindfulness and well-being and how it plays out in different parts of their lives. And they all gave a short presentation, and the Dalai Lama responded. And the message was, if you could cultivate certain skills like resilience, being able to bounce back from adversity or generosity, doing good in the world. And there's a lot of research showing that actually, that doesn't just make the world a better place. It actually makes you happier if you are more generous yourself. And so if you could cultivate these skills at the individual level, it could have a huge social impact as well.
Well, Steve, thank you so much for stopping by and telling us about it.
Sure, happy to.
Steve Paulson is the executive producer of To the Best of Our Knowledge here at Wisconsin Public Radio, and he joined us to talk about the Dalai Lama's 10th visit to Madison. He was here yesterday.
Coming up, we talk about new calls from Wisconsin environmental groups for the EPA to get involved in protecting water in Kewaunee County. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.